All right, a few people trickling in, and we're going to get started here this morning. We're talking about, of course, the subject of church history. Church history. We are on lesson number four here this morning. Lesson number four. And specifically, on here, lesson number four, we're going to talk about the subject of Darwinianism, or Darwinism, as I have up there. That's going to dominate our time here this morning, as well as it will come up again a number of times as this becomes a very important issue for the Christian church in the late 1800s and into the 1900s and into the present. Now, just by way of introduction, you remember that last week we focused on Charles Spurgeon. We saw his battle against Unitarian theology. That was a denial of the Trinity. It also ended up denying other things such as the deity of Christ and other very important Christian doctrines and dogmas. Charles Spurgeon, we learned, the Baptist in London, Charles Spurgeon was really the first, he was the first prominent individual in the 1800s, the late 1800s, to really battle against a growing liberal theology. There are other examples of it, but Spurgeon by far is prominent. And we noted last week that he both lost and won. He both lost and won. Remember, said he lost in that the Baptist Union, the group of Baptists in London, an association there, eventually kicked him out of the Baptist Union. But he won in the sense that today, if you visit, if you see what the Baptist Union has become, nearly 140 years after Spurgeon was kicked out, or 130 years, excuse me, nearly 130 years after Spurgeon was kicked out, the Baptist Union today is made up of all sorts of aberrant theology within it. There are a few gospel-preaching people within the Baptist Union today, but largely not, and they are increasingly drifting into theological liberalism. He lost that battle, but he won in that his church, the Metropolitan Tabernacle, still is a gospel-preaching church to this day in the city of London. So he lost, but he won. Now, this week, I mentioned last week that this week we're going to be talking about Darwinian influences, the influence of Darwin. And I mentioned that the main issue that Spurgeon faced in his time period, the issue that he fought most against, was the Unitarian type theology and influence, but he also began in his latter years to see the growing problem of Darwin and his influence upon the churches in England. And it's not just going to be England, it's going to be embraced wholesale throughout much of Europe in the churches there, and of course in the United States have great influence as well. And although Spurgeon was not always clear on how he clear on some issues regarding Darwinian thought, it was the main point that was that he did not believe the core ideas of Darwinian thought, that species actually could grow and evolve into something that they previously were not. Now, so this week we're going to focus just a little bit on a Darwinian thought and see a little bit about that. Now, specifically, we're going to ask a question broadly about the culture, not only of England, of Europe, but also the United States, and ask how could Darwin's ideas be accepted? How could they actually be accepted? And here's what I mean by that. If you go in the early 1800s, from virtually everyone. Now, there are a few exceptions, you can find them, but virtually everyone believing that God created the world, that God created the various species of the world directly and supernaturally. Early 1800s, by the 1870s, to essentially most of the scientific and much of the religious communities of the world, of the Western civilization, saying that the species evolved from lower life forms, including species of man. So how do you go from this to that so fast? Maybe you've thought about that before, maybe you haven't. And my point here this morning is not to argue for or against The subject of Darwinian evolution, if in case you want to know, I'm against most of it. And I'll explain what I mean by most a little bit here. My point is not to argue for or against the subject of evolution. My point this morning is just say, how did you get from pretty much a wholesale acceptance that God supernaturally created everything to saying all of these things evolved from lower life forms? How did you do that in a period, really, that ends up being roughly around 50 years? And I just want to take you through a little journey here to help set the stage for the way people thought and felt, at least the best we can tell, in this period. And we're focusing ultimately around the period of the 1870s. That's when Spurgeon battled against the liberal theology and was already beginning to battle against Darwinian ideas. But just in general, what leads to this? What experiences lead to this kind of pretty massive change in the way that people think about the world and how they got there and their place in the world? Now, I want to start with something that is known as modernization. Modernization. All right? And modernization, of course, is a relatively new idea in human history. Modernity, properly speaking, begins somewhere in the 1800s, depending on your definition of things. And as we think about the subject of modernization, I have a question for you, and I'd love for you to answer. What would life be like in Paris in 1830? What kind of things do you experience in 1830? All right, so some of you are good history people. Some of you can guess. I don't care. What? Poor sanitation. Very good. Very poor sanitation. What you have up there, this is actually a photograph of an area of Paris that was not changed until much later. That would be an average street in Paris. You can see the buildings. I know that's hard to see. I should have blown this one up, but you can see the buildings on both sides, and down below, that's the street. That's the way most of the streets in Paris would have been in 1830, and they would have been filled with garbage and also human waste. There would have been a lot of it there. Very poor sanitation. Okay, what else is going on in Paris in 1830? What's life like? How are we getting around? What?
Animal transportation.
Animal transportation, all right? And even on that, don't think in terms of the more modern buggy idea. I know modern buggy, right? Think largely in terms of horse and cart, right? Right. We haven't even got to, we'll talk about this in a few moments, in London where they develop actually the horse-drawn bus. You have your first mass transportation developed. That's not even being done. For one thing, how would you do it in that? You couldn't get them around, okay? So really narrow, streets, animal transportation. Anything else that you know about in this time period?
Why a lot of rats.
Oh, yeah, you have a dirty, filthy city, a dirty and filthy city. In fact, though people talked about Paris, even at that time being a beautiful city, there's records of people who go away from Paris for a while, they come back and they go, this place is terrible, in essence. It's really, really...
It was the steam, but it has started.
Yeah, it hasn't started yet. Has not started yet. If you think, yeah, go back here, Dave. No refrigeration, all right? So things are hand brought in, food and life like that. The smells would have been everywhere. And I'll just mention a couple. Go ahead.
One that we don't even understand so much today even, but no exchange rate in larger buildings. So people actually couldn't think even as well because the air that they were taking in didn't have the oxygen content that it needed.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, we've got, you know, the cities are full of people. You know, air-to-air exchangers weren't invented yet. You also have little things that aren't so little when you think about it. Jake mentioned, you know, steam-powered stuff. Largely, that there are some of those things being invented, but they're not wide-scale implemented yet. A huge development was in 1843, was the invention in England of the steam-powered printing press. Before that, largely, and that actually had a roller that would actually be able to roll up. Before that, you were still using the whole method, essentially, there are variations in it approved, but essentially of pressing down sheets of paper and pulling them out one by one and collating them into books or making leaflets or magazines or leaflets or newspapers. Books and newspapers are still very slowly distributed. All right, so the city is still, it's not medieval, although you would have seen a lot of medieval architecture, but it's pretty basic. The Industrial Revolution hasn't happened yet.
Water supply,
yeah, you got that issue as well. Water supply was very difficult to deal with, of course, with the river in Paris that helped with that, but that wasn't exactly the cleanest thing. A couple out there if you got. You still had the strong influence of the monarchy. Yes, in 1830. Of course, the French, you know, they kind of flip-flop back and forth for a whole bunch of times about whether they want a king or not. But you do still have, in the broader European world, monarchies are still very powerful. Very powerful. Now, let's think about this. And I've got some listings here. I forgot I should have put these up. It's overcrowded. That's one, by the way. Europe grows in population. From 1800 to 1900, the estimates are from about 185 million to 400 million people from 1800 to 1900. And huge percentages of those people are moving into the cities. So it is crowded, very, very crowded. Narrow streets, as I mentioned, filled with garbage and human waste. You've already mentioned travel on foot and then other things. Now let's ask another question. What would Paris be like in 1870? What would Paris be like in 1870? So that's 40 years later. What's it like? What's that? Much cleaner. Much cleaner. Anybody remember there's a very significant event that happens in Europe's or in France's history? Really important leader that makes a lot of very dictatorial. What's that? You got Napoleon comes to power. Does anybody remember what Napoleon did with the city of Paris? He did that, but even more broadly, do you know? Yeah.
Basically rebased the city, made it look good.
Yes. He tackled everything of the city. In fact, he puts in power a houseman, and my French isn't good, so I'm not sure how you say that in French. Houseman, I get that, but how do you say George's in France? I don't know. I don't know French, so there's my ignorance on display. But this guy, Houseman, was hired to reconstruct and modernize the city. In 1853, he was in that position. Basically, his job, he was a baron, and his job was essentially to remake Paris. Just with the growing technologies. He actually reconstructed 60% of the city in 17 years. And when I say reconstructed, I don't mean just, coming in there and, putting up new trim in the place. I mean, we're talking about leveling most of the city, building entire new, as somebody mentioned here, sewer systems, water systems, widen the streets. There's what Paris looks like after Haussmann is done. Right, that's actually a painting done around the time period that he would have been around. He uprooted actually about 350,000 people from their dwellings in order to pull this off. By the way, if you ever wonder why the French were unstable, this was part of it. That really ticks people off when you're told you have to get out of your house. Uprooted 350,000 people from their dwellings. He built wide streets for faster travel. He created parks and open spaces, which still define Paris today. I've not been there, but so I'm told in pictures. You can see lots of open spaces and park. Public lighting was created. He had installed over 20,000 gas outlets for lights in the city to be in. So you go from a very dark, narrow city to something that is radically transformed. People of the city eventually, and I got a little ahead of myself there, that's London. People of the city actually eventually start living in what we think of today as apartment buildings more. The wealthy and the middle class would have lived on the first floors while the servants and the poor lived higher up. And it's not long before many other European and English cities are starting to be transformed in very similar ways. Okay, so just some radical transformation takes place. Similarly, if we ask the same kind of question, what would London be like in the 1830s? You have essentially the same kinds of things. People live, if they live in the city, they're still living largely off the land. They depended upon people very close to the city working the ground for their livelihood. Some people would commute into the city with the goods to be sold there in London. But largely, you're still an agrarian culture and society. That's the majority of people in Europe and England in the 1830s. But of course, if we ask, what would London be like in the 1870s, similar to that of Paris, life has totally changed. As I mentioned earlier, you have horse-drawn buses. The city is now a 24-hour machine as gas lights are being installed everywhere. This little, you know, not very important invention, right, known as the railroad comes along. Of course, that's extremely important in England and in Europe. Railway has connected all of England and most of England and Europe by the late 1800s. Give you an idea of how fast it grew. In 1860, there were an estimated 300 million passenger trips by rail per year. By 1880, there were 1.3 billion passenger trips per year. All right, so massive change the way the world is connected.
In comparison to our transit system in the metro area, we reached that goal. It's 85 plus million rides.
85 what?
Million.
85 million rides just for the city of Minneapolis, okay. Twin City Metro, okay, yeah. So obviously we're doing more, especially if you consider flights and things like that today, but still a whole different way of thinking about things. You know, we went from traveling on foot to, I mean, you could get across the continent in fairly short order and for not that much, relatively speaking, expense. By the 1870s, the telegraph is becoming used. Work is also done at a factory, largely for more and more people away from their home. Now, that's actually almost everybody in this room. We think about work and we think about going to work. In 1830, you didn't think about that for most people. Work was you walked outside, you got down on your hands and knees, or you used your tools that you had for the implements on the farm. Coal and steam-powered machines are everywhere in London. I mean, really, London is the powerhouse for the Industrial Revolution. So this is modernity. Things are changing rapidly. Your whole experience of life. Now, that has a number of effects on society. Several of them I'll just note here. First of all, traditions are overthrown. So traditionally, you spent most of your life working on the farm, working with your family, staying in relatively secluded communities. So last week we talked about Charles Spurgeon. Spurgeon grows up in a village, and most of his life is spent with just a handful of people. But by the time he is of age, he makes the trek to London for school. And by the time he's out of school, London is developing into a major metropolitan city, and where the exchange of ideas is happening all of the time. And people are leaving their homes and their communities, and they're going to the cities. All right, so we say, you know, in America, you know, our small towns are drying up and so on. Well, this has been going on for a long time, right? Very, very long time. So tradition is being overthrown. Here's another thing to think about, and I have this listed this way on purpose. Progress, quote unquote, progress is seen everywhere. I mean, whatever field of life you're thinking about, there is progress. Part of the reason, just alone, that Europe is able to grow so rapidly is the mortality rate of infants and children just plummets. You know, you read in the 1700s and the 1600s and even in the early 1800s of families that would have 10 children, but only 3 or 4 of them would survive. Well, that's happening less and less. This is, by the way, stunning to think about. Even as early as 1900, 5 out of every 100 children that were born would die before the age of 2 years old. Okay, that's not including miscarriages and things like that. Well, even in the 1800s, those numbers were much higher, but they're falling rapidly. Progress is seen in the fields of medicine, of course, in the machine age that is taking up. I mean, knowledge is exploding across Europe and England, and also in the New World, in the Americas as well. Things are improving, and even there's a word that gets thrown around, things are evolving. They're getting better. You see poorer things, they're getting into better things. Things are getting better and better all around. And what that meant was that all of society was ripe for intellectual and cultural change. So the way they think about things and the way they do things and judge things, that's ripe for change. This is what's happening in Europe, in London, in this time period. So there's one important reality that is going on that leads to the openness to the idea of evolution. Everything around us is evolving. Where does that come from? How does that get here? Now, there's another important factor, and I won't spend too much time on this because we've talked about it already, and that is of natural laws. By this, part of natural laws would include the subject today of natural law, which has to do with jurisprudence and morality. But broadly speaking, the idea of the laws of nature were exploding. And I just want to highlight the shift in thinking about the laws of nature, and I'll explain what I mean by that a little bit. Now, before I explain, I want to say we've talked about natural laws several times already, both in previous church history courses and also now. And I want to be clear, because I've had some people ask me about this, I am not against the idea of natural law. The idea of natural law grows out of the Christian view of the world that says that God is a God of order and he has established an ordered world. So it's a very much a Christian idea. And I'm very much appreciative of the laws of nature. Without the laws of nature, we would have no hope of technological advancement. All right? In other words, if gravity was something that existed today, but sometime tomorrow might not, even as something as basic as the wheel would be a worthless investment. All right, all sorts of technology, if the laws of nature were shifting all the time, we'd have no way to actually advance technologically. All right, so laws of nature I'm not against, but there is a shift that happens, especially becoming more and more clear in the 1800s about natural laws that is quite dramatic. By the late 1700s and into the 1800s, you increasingly find that people are looking for natural laws to explain everything. Okay? So they're looking to the laws of nature for an explanation of all things. The supernatural is not out, but it's on its way out. All right? And so people don't think in terms of God controlling everything directly. At best, they think about God controlling everything providentially, which I'm fine with those statements, but that would be at the best end of things. A lot of people are thinking in terms of God controlling everything like the deist would, where he just winds up the clock and lets it go, right? And all the laws are fixed. Now, earlier naturalists, or those of us of natural laws, had grounded their beliefs in God's ordered world. So, in other words, natural laws were derived from God, and we could discover them and use them to our advantage. I'll give you an example in history. A man who's up there on the picture, his name is John Ray. John Ray lived from 1627 to 1705. He was a pioneer in the classification of plants. He also later applied his ideas to animals. Others took that further. And he classified animals or plants, and then later animals, by the similarity of their features. So actually getting an ordered system to classify the world around us. He was also the first to define and use the word species. He's the first to define and use the word species in the late 1600s. In fact, in a book that he wrote that was entitled, I believe this comes from this one, The Wisdom of God Manifested in the Works of Creation. That ought to tell you right there what he thought about things, okay? This is how he defines and he describes the laws of nature, though he does not use in this quote, laws, you see that he believes in a law, and he ultimately will believe that this law comes from God, and we're to trust it as from God. So this is about his criteria for classifying plants and later animals. He says this, no surer criterion for determining the species has occurred to me than the distinguishing features that perpetuate themselves and propagation from seed. Thus, no matter what variations occur in the individual or the species, if they spring from the seed of one and the same plant, they are accidental variations and not such as to distinguish a species. Animals, likewise, that differ specifically preserve their distinct species permanently. By the way, you can tell he writes in the 1600s. One species never springs from the seed of another, nor vice versa. So God has established certain species. He's made them that way. And there are variations that come about, but they're categorized in a specific species. And one species, he says, does not give rise to another. Can you think of somebody who's going to contradict that very much in the mid-1800s? Okay, of course, we're going to talk about Darwin here in a moment. And this, he saw, was the law of God. Not the Bible law of God, but it's a natural law. Okay. Ray was grounded in theological truths. He was trained as an ordained minister and also in what would be known then as a natural philosopher. Yes?
I was just going to say that this actually does come from Scripture, because the Scripture talks about how each animal is after its own kind.
Absolutely.
We're talking about kinds here.
Absolutely.
That was, if you will, degraded later by Darwin.
Yes, you're absolutely correct. This would have agreed wholeheartedly with the Genesis description of the creation of the world. And Ray was going around the world and documenting these things and showing it. I mean, now, unfortunately, from Ray and some of his followers, they began to think in terms of a fixation of species. Yes, sir?
There's actually some evolutionary thought in that statement.
Absolutely.
The word accidental.
Yes, absolutely. We're going to get to that. All right? Of variations, okay?
You could say random mutations.
Random mutations, absolutely. Now, having said that, I don't know of any thoughtful person who would, even Christians within the Bible, who would disagree if you understood Ray in his context for what he's saying. What he's saying is, yes, over time, species do variate, but they always stay within the same species. That's the context of that quote. All right, and accidental, if you really pressed Ray on that, he doesn't mean by random chance. Because as I said, he's publishing this under the wisdom of God manifested in the works of creation. So he sees this under God's ordaining influences. Yes?
You see an attack too to faith in there is a point where man's understanding stops. And these are knowledgeable individuals. They're people whose body of knowledge is contained in a certain sphere of influence. And as modernization occurs, they realize their sphere of influence to be so much smaller than it used to be when everything was simple. I mean, there was a time when You know, you might not be a tanner, but you know how to tan hides. You may not, you know, run cattle, but you knew how to run cattle. I mean, your body of knowledge was as large as the civilization you grew up in. But now things are changing, and you see it right here. He used the word accidental because that's where his understanding begins to stop. And Darwin moves outside of that with a body of knowledge that's actually a supposition. And nobody knows how to attack that because their body of knowledge doesn't include that at all.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, we've got, things are definitely changing, even in Ray's time period in the late 1600s. And the level, the amount of knowledge itself, just the sheer data is exploding. I mean, it's just absolutely exploding. So things are changing. Now, unfortunately, Ray and his followers begin to be known for their belief in a fixation of species. And Darwin, in his book, Origin of the Species, of which I am currently reading, I actually read it before, and I decided in preparation for this, I should read it. Unfortunately, my week kind of exploded, and I only got about halfway through the book. But I plan to finish it. Darwin actually, without mercy, picks on this idea of a fixation of species and actually creates, I think, what would be a caricature of Ray and others unfairly. And that's just me looking at it, and others will say similar things. And Darwin painted people like Ray and his latter followers as totally missing the idea of the transmutation of forms. Now, so Ray says, laws ultimately grounded in what God has established. God has established. Now, let's contrast that to Charles Darwin and his view of natural laws. Okay? So I'm going to cheat a little bit because I didn't actually get to read up to this point, but I've read this section of Darwin before. And I'm going to give you the closing paragraphs to The Origin of Species, if you've never read it before. Give you the closing paragraphs. And this is from the first edition. For those of you who know anything about this, there were subsequent editions to which there are words added. And I'll explain that in a moment. But this is his first edition published in 1859? I didn't write it down. Is that right? 1859, I think, is when he published. And this is a longer quote, okay, so I'm going to move my way through this. He says, it is interesting, and these are the concluding paragraphs. It is interesting to contemplate an entangled bank clothed with many plants of many kinds, with birds singing on the bushes, with various insects flittering about, and with worms crawling through the damp earth, and to reflect that these elaborately constructed forms, so different from each other and dependent on each other in so complex a manner, have been produced by laws acting around us. Okay? They've been produced by laws acting around us. Notice that emphasis on natural law. These laws, taken in the largest sense, being growth with reproduction. Here's the laws that he has elaborated on in his book. These laws, taken in the largest sense, being growth with reproduction, inheritance, which is almost implied by reproduction, variability from the indirect and direct action of the external conditions of life and from use and disuse, a ratio of increase so high as to lead to a struggle for life, and as a consequence to natural selection, entailing divergence of character and the extinction of less improved forms. Thus, from the war of nature, from famine and from death, the most exalted object which we are capable of conceiving, namely the production of higher animals, directly follows. So in other words, the laws of nature have produced the animals that we see today. And this is how he feels about it. This is the last quote of the last paragraph of his book. There is grandeur, in other words, this is wonderful to him, in this view of life, with its several powers having been originally breathed into a few forms or into one. Notice that, a few forms or into one. In other words, this is where it all started. And that, whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. Now, you notice, if you might catch this, that he speaks about in that first part there, having been originally breathed into a few forms or into one. What did Mr. Darwin mean by that?
He believed in God.
Well, in his subsequent editions, he added this phrase, having originally breathed by the Creator into a few forms or into one. However, there is much, much debate as to whether Darwin actually believed that. Okay, and I am not sure on that question. It is clear that he was under massive pressure by the people of his day not to contradict the religious authorities, including his wife, who was a devout Christian. Yeah.
Wasn't Darwin's original training in theology?
He started for a short time in theology, but I don't believe he ever finished. But that would have been very common to start in theology in that day, which we're going to get to in a moment. Yeah. It's also there are later entries, even by Darwin, that seems to grow away from the idea of God. But it's unclear at best. What is clear is the phrase, by their Creator, was imposed by his publisher and other people saying you need to add that into that phrase, into that statement. I'm going to go right here and then go back. So, go ahead.
Times to which slide it was at the beginning, he said the forces, the laws of nature, but then he had two terms after that. One was death, and what was the other one?
Be easier for me to read it off here than to go back.
Kind of these are the forces that are causing this beauty to happen.
Yes.
Nature, but it was something and death. Famine and death. Thus, from the war of nature, from famine and death, the most exalted object which your people are conceiving, namely, affecting their animals, directly follows. That sticks in my mind because I remember hearing on public radio evolutionary biologists being interviewed by public radio hosts, and they were honest intellectually, in which they said, this is what the evolutionary biologist ethicist at the University of Minnesota struggles, she's head of the department down there, is the fact of the matter that these are the forces that create beauty. These are the forces that whole survival of the fittest and the ethical issue that comes out of it. This comes from famine and death.
Yeah. There are real, real philosophical and moral problems with that. If you didn't hear that, he's pointing out that was the head of the biology department at.
Well, she's an evolutionary biologist and ethicist.
An ethicist.
She did not have an answer for that.
At the U of M.
This is a thing that I struggle with because it makes me want to reject evolutionary thinking as far as the origin of the species and the forces. Is that natural thing is that. These are the forces that are productive. Death, survival of the fittest, that whole concept.
Yeah. In other words, the ethical dilemma that Darwinians have is that the forces that create what he describes as, here's the next slide, this grandeur in this view of life and the beauty that he talked about earlier are powered by death and a survival of the fittest.
And she went further with that, saying, then why would we help people who need help?
Yeah.
It's the medical ethics. Who do you help? Which is the child, this person? Who do you help and why do you help them? What's the reason that you help them internally? Why are you motivated to help them if this is what you believe?
Yeah, there are serious ethical impacts. Yes?
I believe at the beginning of Darwin's book, he has a statement in there, something to the effect that he didn't know that this, I mean, this is a theory. He didn't know that this is for sure a fact, per se, these things that he was presenting.
I just read his introduction this week, and
that's what I kind of understand.
Yeah, that's a nice. He gives the classic scientific.
And he leaves it up the air.
Well, most good scientists will always say, well, you know, these things are never for certain, and people build on. But if you read his literature, he's very dogmatic. Very dogmatic, and he slams the earlier view continually. In fact, the word creator comes up a bunch of times in Origin of the Species, but it is all. Unless you count the one where he added here at the end in the second and subsequent editions, they are all really poking fun at or putting down people who hold that the Creator established certain fixed species. So he is very dogmatic. But I mean, all good scientists are always going to say, of course, there could be things that I need to learn and grow in, and you know.
So they found this mixture of species.
Yeah. Well, again, I'm not here to argue for or against Darwinian evolution. I mean, that's not my point today.
A very fundamental difference just popped into my mind, and that is that if it was a Christian, a believer of God, death is the enemy. For an honest evolutionist, death is the dream.
And this is exactly what you guys were saying, yeah. Yep. Now, the main point I want you to see is that there is real question as to whether Darwin viewed these laws as coming from God. He may have seen that, but it's shaky at best. Now, what's clear, though, is the people who come after him and really wholeheartedly embrace his ideas and become his largest spokesman and spokespersons, they do not believe in God. And that leads to, very quickly, the idea of science and religion. Science and religion. Up until the 1800s, there's no split, no serious split existed between science and religion. By the mid-1800s, that split is certainly occurring, and I have more that I could say, but I need to hurry for time's sake here. The guy you see up here, his name is Thomas Huxley. Thomas Huxley, some of you are familiar with him. Huxley was known as Darwin's bulldog. Okay, that was the nickname that was given to him. And he was provoking, in the late 1800s, he provokes a split between theology and religion. Now, up until this point, largely all what we would think of today as scientists, although that term didn't really exist as such, what we think of as scientists were all trained theologians, pretty much. All right? The leading scientists were clergymen in the Church of England. In England, per se. Newton, trained theologian. Ray, trained theologian, even as Brother Ward mentioned. Even Darwin had theology in his background. But Huxley and others began to push for a split. And Huxley was particularly dismissive, although he's a brilliant man and some of his ideas are very foundational for other scientific advancement. He really pushed for a split between science and religion. And the laws of nature began to be seen as something distinct from coming from God. Right? Now, that's not always true, and there's still people today, many in the scientific community, who would say that the laws of nature do come from God. But there is also a growing number of people who split from that idea. And that's going to continue to grow into the 1900s, and of course you see it today. Not everybody. But there were many, and in this day, that split is beginning to come. So, by the time that you get to the early 1900s, and even today, it is interesting that somehow, in some sense, we now hold scientists as the new preachers of our day who tell us how we are to live our lives. And you see this all the time, right? Well, scientists tell us that, fill in the blank, therefore, we should do, fill in the blank. Just read the front page of the newspapers for a few weeks and you'll see this constantly. Scientists become the new preachers of the day, whereas before this point, good or bad, the scientists were actually theologians. And you don't see that as much anymore today. All right, so it's a massive change that happens, and as the split happens, it allows people to embrace Darwinian thought. And we'll say more about that in the coming weeks, because it's going to come up a number of times in American and English church history. All right, I'm over time, so we got to be done. Good questions, good comments, appreciate discussion. Let's pray. Father in heaven, use these words today to help us think clearly about matters of your church, both in the past and also we see the effects of this today. And give us wisdom to think through these things. We pray this in Christ's name. Amen.